Welcome to the People and Performance Podcast, offering tips and expert insights into the strategic capabilities, behaviors, and results needed to grow and sustain employee performance.
Welcome to another episode of the People and Performance Podcast. This is Bill Banham. My awesome co-host Chris Buehling is away today. Our guest on the show is Ian Ziskin, president of Exec Excel Group, LLC. Ian has over 40 years of experience as a business and HR leader, board advisory member, coach, consultant, entrepreneur, teacher, speaker, and author. Ian has written or co-edited 4 books, including The Secret Sauce for Leading Transformational Change, which came out in 2022, and we'll be talking about that in today's episode. And if you enjoy today's episode with Ian, please remember to like, comment, and subscribe. Hey, Ian, welcome to the People and Performance Podcast.
Hey, Bill, thanks for having me.
I'm very interested in the fact that you are the co-founder and leader of the Consortium for Change, C4C, which is a community of coaches and consultants. Can you tell us about that group, why you started it, and how they help HR pros, leaders, and employees?
Yes, happy to do that. Started in about 2018, co-founded it with a colleague of mine, a woman by the name of Lacey Leone McLaughlin. And we've now got about 75, actually a little bit more than 75 members, all of whom are independent coaches and consultants in a variety of different areas, including with a lot of expertise in the transformational change space, among other things. A great group of people all running their own independent businesses quite successfully, but we founded it with a couple of objectives in mind, actually 3 primary objectives. One was to enable people to scale up for bigger projects. Obviously, it's difficult as an individual consultant, a solopreneur, if you will, sometimes to compete for business when you're up against a larger firms with more infrastructure and resources. So that's been an important element. The second area was referral of business, in the sense that somebody may come across a piece of business that's not really in their wheelhouse or area of interest or expertise, or they just simply don't have time to do the work. Being able to turn to other trusted colleagues to hand off the work and know that your client is going to be well taken care of, and receive a little bit of referral compensation back for your trouble, has been a successful aspect of C4C. But probably the thing that over the last few years has grown in emphasis and benefit the most is the third reason we started it, which is essentially to build a community of like-minded people who are willing to share what they know and learn from others in a spirit of abundance, you know, where all of us basically can do better than any of us individually might be able to do on our own. And that's been our operating principle, or primary operating principle, since we founded it back in 2018.
Okay, so you mentioned your colleague there, Leanne, who you co-founded with. And I was, as part of my homework, I was reading through some recent articles and posts that you've shared on LinkedIn. One from yesterday, as we record this particular interview, there was one that you published yesterday. In it, you said, leaders who are clear about goals, expectations, and the path forward are better able to get team buy-in, hold their teams accountable, and improve chances for success. Makes sense to me, Ian. But what are some of those common barriers that leaders put up to avoid change?
I think one of the most common barriers leaders put up to avoid or perhaps hinder or undermine change is, in the spirit of trying to provide clear direction and to energize people to embrace change and then execute on it, they quite often do a terrible job of listening. So everybody's all about the importance of communication and establishing a vision and a compelling reason for change, which of course leads people in leadership roles to do a lot of talking and telling to try to provide some clarity about why we're changing and what it actually is that we're trying to change. And that's all, you know, extremely appropriate, but overdone, which it often is, they forget to listen. Usually the people that they're trying to help support or embrace the change are much closer to the customer. They're much closer to the problems, issues, and challenges of the organization. They have great ideas. They have great energy. And they're actually willing to try to help to make things better, but very difficult for them to contribute if they don't have a forum to be heard and avenues to be listened to. And a lot of leaders I find in the spirit of trying to compel change and communicate a rationale for change tend to forget they should be listening an awful lot more than they should be talking or telling.
So specifically when it comes to HR practitioners, Ian, how important is listening as a skill? Should you get into HR? I guess that's my question. Should you get into HR if you're not a good listener?
I think you should think very hard and long about getting into HR if you're not a good listener. That probably applies to leaders outside of HR as well, but particularly in the HR profession, which, as I said during my introduction, I've been lucky enough to, you know, be in a career that I've loved and be very passionate about. But I also feel like I'm, you know, reasonably objective in terms of what we as HR professionals do well and not so well. And one of the best areas that we can contribute, you know, if we do it right, is to really hear and try to understand the mindset of the people who are working in the organization, who I think generally speaking, if you look at it from an optimistic point of view, which I try to do, most people want to contribute, want to do their best, want to learn new things, new skills, new capabilities. They may not like change, and we'll come back to that maybe a little bit later when we talk about the book, but what they do like is winning and success. And I think HR people who are particularly good at listening to and understanding the mindset, the skill set, the expectations, the needs, what motivates people, what engages them, those HR people are generally, in my experience, much more effective, much more trusted, much more credible than HR people who are not good listeners.
Okay, so you're a successful HR leader yourself. What are some of those tools that you had in your toolkit to understand the mindset of colleagues? Maybe you can share a few of those. Are we talking about things like 360s? Are we talking about technology for constant feedback? Are we talking about the use of things like town halls? Is it just about making sure that the message is coming from on top down, whether that's through email or whatever else that looks like? What are some of those top tools that you used in your time when you were an HR leader?
Yeah, top tools, and I'll qualify the use of the term tools simply by saying that, you know, the technology has changed over the years that I've been in the profession. You know, for example, 40 years ago when I started as an HR person, you know, we weren't talking about engagement surveys at the time, and we weren't talking about artificial intelligence and automated tools of any kind at that time. But what we were talking about then, and I think are still relevant even today, is the mentality associated with reaching out to people in the organization, you know, where they live, where they sit, focusing on the problems and challenges that they're dealing with, and asking a lot of questions. I think, you know, really for me, one of the most important assets I've tried to cultivate as an HR leader over the course of my career is to refine using the art of the question. So a lot of HR people, for example, talk about wanting to be viewed as more strategic and more of a business partner, which I'm a big proponent of course. But one of the better ways to demonstrate that you're strategic and that you're a good partner to the business is to actually ask thoughtful, provocative questions that cause people to think twice and three times about what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're doing it, how the business actually makes money, and how do you win in the marketplace? Because fundamentally, that's what strategy is all about, is helping the organization figure out how to win Those are the kinds of tools and techniques that I've tried to employ over the course of my career, not only as an HR person inside of companies, but also as a coach and a consultant working with a wide variety of different clients now. And that's served me well, you know, over the course of my career.
Okay, now it's time to focus on your new book, your latest book, The Secret Sauce for Leading Transformational Change. What are some of the key questions that the book explores and addresses?
We really, at the beginning of this whole project of putting this book together, we're trying to answer some logical questions and maybe some unexpected questions as well. One of the things that I began thinking about was the analogy, or what became called the pizza analogy in the book, is what does pizza have to do with leading transformational change? And hopefully we'll have time to get back to some of the answers associated with that in a few minutes. But we were also looking at some more typical kinds of questions you might imagine, such as those leaders who are highly successful at leading transformational change, what do they actually do? And secondarily, why is it that we so often fail to successfully lead transformational change? What can we learn from those failures as well? We also had a hypothesis that we were exploring throughout the book, which was that all transformation is change, but is all change transformational? And it turns out, at least in our view, having put this book together, not all change is in fact transformational. And then finally, for me, what was really the most important question to try to explore was the question of from what to what. In other words, trying to understand, get your arms around what an organization is trying to drive toward, while at the same time understanding and appreciating and not messing up, if at all possible, the place that they came from and the things that the organization has historically done extremely well, or that the individual or the team has done extremely well, that you want to make sure that you preserve and not throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, in the name of introducing large-scale transformational change. There are certain things that have to be preserved, have to be protected, have to be understood, because they're foundational to whatever future success the organization is going to have.
Okay, thank you very much. You've got loads of contributors who are in this book, or featured in this book, or authored in this book. In fact, there are 25 essays, Ian, from transformational change experts, and 8 interviews with CEOs and other senior leaders. What are some of the common themes that emerged from all of these perspectives?
Yeah, so one of the things that was really exciting to me about this book was I quickly figured out I wasn't really smart enough to write a book on this topic, or perhaps any other topic on my own, and wanted it to be a collaborative effort with a collective point of view, hopefully finding some mutually reinforcing themes and some consistencies, which we certainly did, and I'll come back to those in just a second, but also some divergent points of view, different ways of thinking about leading transformational change, which were also equally instructive. I've become fond of referring to the book as 200 voices and under 200 pages, not only from the perspective of having these multiple voices from the essays and the interviews that you referred to, Bill, but also a lot of survey input and the like, but also trying to take on the mission of collecting those perspectives in a book that literally would be under 200 pages, came in about 199 pages, I think, to be more specific. One of the things we learned from our publisher, but I think we all know this, including your listeners, intuitively, is it's getting harder and harder for people to make the time to read books. So 350 and 400 page books can be very educational, instructive, but it's also difficult to make the time to do it. So we tried to be as practical and brief as we could be. Now, in collecting all of this different input and all these different voices that came through the essays and the survey and the interviews that we did, there clearly were a number of things that were fairly consistent. I'll just give you a few examples that popped out for sure. One of which is the idea of understanding the term VUCA, which is also often used in the leading change space, which stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And a lot of the essays and the interviews talked about some version of all of this volatility and the uncertainty and the complexity and the ambiguity associated with change, but in a way that was unique, I thought. A lot of books I've read on change tend to go down the path of acknowledging the existence of VUCA, if you will, but trying to somehow minimize it or control it or manage it or restrict it so that you can overcome some obstacles and successfully achieve change. In our book, one of the things I really valued about it was the consistent message of embrace VUCA, you know, expect volatility, expect uncertainty, expect complexity, expect ambiguity, design your approach to change, assuming those things are inevitable and that they must be embraced rather than trying to control or minimize them. The reason why that became so important was to reduce surprises, reduce the fact that people would get highly frustrated with putting a plan in place to drive change, only to recognize that it almost immediately became obsolete and would have to be adjusted along the way. And that was a very common theme throughout many of the essays and interviews. I think another one I'll just mention for the sake of time was the importance of diversity, diverse perspectives, diverse thinking, diverse contributions from a wide variety of different kinds of people, you know, who in every example that was given in every essay and every interview came through loud and clear that having a group of people who bring very different perspectives and ways of thinking about the problem to the table is going to lead you to a better solution in driving large-scale transformational change than surrounding yourself simply with people who think like you, who look like you, who have the same experience base as you do. Even though it feels like you're getting support and reinforcement, you're actually minimizing your ability to construct the best solution in the time available that you have.
Ian, that almost takes us to the end of this particular interview. Before we do wrap up, though, how can our listeners connect with you and get a copy of your new book?
Great. Thank you for asking. We do have a book website dedicated specifically to the book, which is www.transformationalchangebook.com, which is a one-stop shop for learning more about the book, chapter summaries, understanding a little bit better the backgrounds of the contributing authors, being able to order the book for those people who might be interested in doing so at a discount through our publisher, even though it's also available at a discount through Amazon. So there are a couple of ways that people can get access. It's also a place where people can go to see or hear some of the podcast interviews that I've done or other presentations that we've done around the book if they want a little bit better insight into how the book is talked about and thought about and the kinds of questions that people are asking us. So www.transformationalchangebook.com is the place to go.
Perfect. Well, that just leaves me to say for today, Ian, thank you very much for being my guest.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the People and Performance Podcast. Follow us on social media and remember to subscribe.